Hello and welcome to Sobre Mesa podcast. My name is Owen Gilmartin, and this week we are talking the Portuguese elections, which yesterday saw the rise of far-right Chega Party, which won 18% of the vote. We are joined from Lisbon by Joana Ramiro, British-Portuguese journalist who's been covering the elections. Hey, Joana.
Hello, hello.
Well,
for a glum day.
Yeah, very glum day, really. No, I mean, I guess that's the issue, no? I mean, was it a little over 8 years ago when António Costa became prime minister, sort of ushering in a mere decade of Iberian social democracy? Portugal and Spain were sort of held up as these exceptions in Europe in which the far right had, you know, didn't have a major presence in the institutions. Obviously, you know, in Spain, we've had Vox, but Vox is sort of, its vote has been capped at 15% in 2019, falling back to 11% last year. In Portugal, Chega got, was it 18, just over 18%? Was that, was the scale of that surge? I mean, they tripled their vote, no, from 7% to 18%. Was that a shock?
They tripled their vote and they quadrupled their seats in parliament, which is quite intense, from 14 to 48, you know. This in a 230-seat parliament. Or in other words, they took a huge chunk of parliament at this point. I guess their rise, even the meteoric rise, was foretold, in as much as the polls constantly put them at around 16, 17%. Yes, it is a little bit higher than that, but abstention has also lowered significantly. Now, that perhaps the combination of these two elements is all the more grim, because one would, I mean, it doesn't have to be ipso facto, but in any case, one would, it would suggest that lower abstention leads to higher voting percentage to the far right, to the populist far right. This is a moment to consider, and particularly because your listeners will be far more versed in this topic than many of the broader audiences I've been speaking to over the last 24 hours, or English-speaking audiences I've been speaking to in the last 24 hours to, your listeners will be far better versed in the intricacies of government and elections in the Iberian Peninsula. And there have been a lot of elections, Spain having taken most of those, but also this being the second snap election since 2019. So the 2019 government fell in 2021, then the 2022 election elected a majority socialist party government again. And yes, and then in October, November last year, snap elections were called again. And now we have this bizarro world we live in now where, you know, socialists and conservatives are very much head to head, but Chega grows, you know, meteorically through, or grows through the ranks, all the more so. Now, you asked me whether this was expected. I mean, I told you from the polls perspective, it was sort of expected. From a on the ground analysis, as in the, you know, the rhetoric, the opinions, the temperature of the thing, I think to a degree it's one of those shocked but not surprised type of results. The normalization of reactionary logic and rhetoric and ideology has been so blatant over the last, well, since 2015, so really, and then Chega appeared, so over the last 8 years, that one cannot be unduly surprised by the result. It is nonetheless bitter, a very bitter pill to swallow, especially in the year that the country is due to celebrate next month, in fact, the 50th anniversary of the revolution that toppled a fascistic dictatorship and, you know, brought democracy to the country. And now we have a party that is profoundly apologetic of that same dictatorship and incredibly, God knows, I'm even at times, it's hard to understand, but denialistic about the revolution. You know, they basically just call it a date rather than an actual shift in paradigm, that they are now the kingmakers, the, you know, sure, third party in parliament, but really the main voice in everything, in social media, in mainstream media, in the main name in the mouths of the Portuguese people at this point. So yeah, it's shock but not surprise is sort of the way I would describe it.
Okay, yeah, I mean, as you said, with the two sort of mainstream parties which have dominated Portuguese politics in recent decades, both sort of, you know, they were basically tied, I guess, would you say, on sort of 28, 29% of the votes.
Yeah, they have less than a 1% point between them.
Exactly. And the center-right coalition led by Luis Montenegro, presumably he will become prime minister, but there's no clear governing majority for him going forward, in terms of, I guess, he will either have to depend on some sort of governing arrangement with the socialists or with Chega, because there's no other possibility. He ruled out a governing arrangement with Chega with the extreme right beforehand. I guess the question is, will he stick to that promise?
Exactly. It is anyone's guess at this point. President Marcel Rebelo de Sousa will, in all likeliness, I mean, I haven't been following the news this morning, as in early this morning, because I've been doing the news myself, either writing pieces or commenting in various outlets. But Marcel Rebelo de Sousa is in all likeliness going to invite the leader of this conservative coalition, Luis Montenegro, to form a government. And then it will, although Marcelo himself, the president himself, has very often and at times controversially suggested that he would not want to see a government shaped or formed with Chega, with an ultimately anti-democratic party. You know, I mean, these things are the definitions that we're giving to it, one should say, for the sake of parity, not that they deserve it, but anyway, that Chega always claims to be a democratic party for democracy and so on and so forth. But obviously their manifesto and their policies suggest otherwise. So Marcel Rebelo de Sousa will invite Luis Montenegro to form a government. But Luis Montenegro won't have a way to form a government, because the only other organization he could rely on to his right would be the Liberals of the Liberal Initiative, but they only got 5% of the vote. So, you know, 29.5 plus 5 or plus 5.1 doesn't add up to a majority. A coalition or some sort of agreement with PS, a coalition is out of the question at this point. Not that it has never happened in Portuguese political history, the so-called Centrão, the big center, but is unlikely at this point, in part because the two parties ideologically at this juncture are very, or trying to define themselves as very separate and very much apart. Also because I suspect PS still has a sneaky hope of trying to form a government with the minority government, but nonetheless a government with the rest of the left. Or even in a sort of more long-term vision, it could not be set aside the possibility that PS thinks we will let this administration run its very short course and then go again into the polls and then basically ramp up support so much for the left at large, but certainly for PS as the main beneficiary of that, that we will then get some sort of majority out of this. That defeats the right and certainly defeats Chega's aim to, you know, get into government on piggybacking on the conservatives of some description. So the crux of the question really is, as you say, whether the Montenegro will go back on his. I wouldn't say pledge, but on his statements that he would not reach out to Chega to form a government, and will backtrack and do it. Another version of what could happen that, you know, Montenegro could argue is, you know, sort of something he never put set aside, will be a sort of like loophole in all of this, is that the AD, the conservative coalition that got the majority of the votes, would get some sort of agreement out of Chega to pass their budget, which is the very first hurdle any government in Portugal needs to pass. Many a government hasn't even really taken power because their budgets were immediately failed in parliament. But yeah, so AD could reach out to Chega for some sort of agreement in order to pass its budget, and then move on as a minority government, relying on Chega where it suits them, and then, you know, like fiscally conservative approaches, lower taxing, etc. But then moving on separately on everything else. That option would both be difficult to arrange without obviously conceding something to Chega. And I don't think Chega would enter such an agreement for free, if you see what I mean, at all. There are massive opportunities, to say the least, but also on a more wider meta sense, it would be incredibly, incredibly dangerous, even more dangerous that we find ourselves now, to open up that precedent, to allow Chega to actually reach power, and to create a precedent, further normalize this party as legitimate as you know, part of a democratic body of, you know, and democratic and, as you say, institutions. It's, you know, I cannot emphasize this enough because I think it's on everyone's mind, including people on the democratic right, by the way, that it is almost pernicious of fate to have turned out this, that the elections have turned out this way on the 50th anniversary of Portugal's democracy.
I mean, obviously, the party itself is, I mean, it's a bit similar to Vox in that sense, is that it was born from a split within the mainstream right party. Andre Ventura was sort of, a dissident sort of on the sort of radical right wing of the party, and had his own sort of, I think the slogan Chega, which means basta, no, enough, in English, you know, initially was a sort of an internal revolt against the former leader. I'm going to mispronounce my Portuguese pronunciation is terrible, but is it Rui Rio?
Rui Rio. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. but it was a sort of revolt against his leadership, a bit the way Vox was, I guess, born out of a revolt against Rajoy's supposed sort of moderate right
socialistic tendencies.
Exactly. Exactly.
He did phrase it over here.
Exactly. Like, yeah, he didn't follow through on his pledge to repeal abortion, etc. I mean, obviously, since then, so if it was born as a sort of internal split. I don't know if this suggests, as in Spain, the fact that Vox was born from a sort of scission of the PP sort of showed how the extreme right was always present, in the sense there was a sort of radical right wing of the PP always there, and particularly in terms of its social power and its social base in the church, you know, in sort of conservative think tanks and institutions, a lot of them ended up going with Vox. What is the relationship between Chega and the mainstream right? And can you talk a little bit about its leader? It seems like, I don't know how charismatic he is, but he has that sort of interesting sort of maybe anti-professional politician trajectory of, I think he was a seminarian, then he became a football commentator. You know, it's sort of a colourful, he has a colourful past in that sense.
It's an ever so slightly different context in Portugal. Obviously, it echoes the two countries are culturally and obviously politically subsequently not that different. And historically as well, whilst I do think that the differences between the two countries occur and stem from their historical differences. And namely, and I'll put this as a sort of contextualizing proviso, the fact that Portugal had a left-wing socialist revolution in 74, that created a whole new constituency for its constitution, rather, for instance, well, possibly also a constituency, to be fair, and also just created a to some degree a mindset change. You know, it was empowering, and you know, it created palpable alternatives, even if only momentary, even if only for 18 months. But people did experiment and did experience something completely different.
Yeah.
And it really did sort of, you know, I feel like saying sort of, what is it? What is the universe brain kind of meta, meme rather, sort of moment, you know, a lot of people, especially those who are still alive and talk about it, mention it as this truly liberating moment in their lives in which they could, again, even if briefly, believe that they could do different things, reach different heights, be that from a individual potential perspective, but also from a collective potential. And we could go on and on about the 25th of April because it's a fascinating moment in history at large, but I'll stop there.
Can I actually jump in and ask you one thing there? Because yeah. I mean, I think the contrast is always fascinating. The Spanish left always obviously looks to Portugal in positive terms, the revolution as opposed to the sort of reformist transition here. One of the clear examples is one of the issues in Spain is the fact of a certain holdover, particularly in the institutions of the state, that there was never a rupture with the Francoist regime. And so there was a holdover in terms of the institutions and the personnel and the institutional culture. When you're talking about judiciary, certain elements within the armed forces, above all the intelligence services, and that probably, you know, for example, you would say that Portugal had a cleaner break, and that probably reflected a sort of cleaner democracy institutionally in the state. But another thing is the society, you know? I mean, the society, like you don't live under a conservative dictatorship for decades without having a certain what we call in Spain sociological Francoism. But like, you know, there must have been still in Portugal quite strong social base for conservatism and including for far right feelings, even if it didn't take political form.
For sure. In Portugal, we label it as either Salazarismo, like Francoism, or Saudosismo. Now, saudade being the word that in Portuguese is not translatable, but means missing something. And so the politics or the ideology of missing something often that never really existed definitely is still very, very present. And it to some degree does permeate throughout the population, regardless of their political position. You know, there's a lot of acquired biases that unfortunately the left isn't exempt of in it, or it's only a purview of the right. But this is exactly where I was going to say, where things are ever so slightly different from a party political perspective in this country, and they have to do with revolution in a sense. So the conservatives here are called the Social Democratic Party for a reason. They originally, whilst they were more conservative than other parties, were supposed to be a social democratic party, because social democracy in the 70s was seen as this relatively conservative for the demands of time. So you know, that's where they stand. Of course, they, even within the PSD, the Social Democrats, there have been more conservative forces, far more to the right than this original social democratic position. But primarily the genesis, and I would say the backbone of the party, is a pro-democracy. It's a democratic conservative organization, political project, and so the anti-democratic.
Sorry. So in that sense, it is, like, I guess there is that's the distinction with Spain, not that there is this broad democratic anti-fascist consensus, I suppose, anti-dictatorship consensus, which just doesn't exist in Spain.
Exactly. And so the more fascistic, if you like, political tendencies, ended up existing either outside of the center mainstream political realm in smaller parties that were outright fascistic, or, well, outright fascistic, probably not, because that would be anti-constitutional, but who, you know, were ultimately fascistic, but hid, covered their politics in order to be legally approved to run for parliament, but never got very far because the game was obvious, or outright in fascist organizations that have existed, underground ever since the revolution, ever since before the revolution, of course. So that has been in that space. When they were further the most reactionary voices or politics in closer to the center, closer to mainstream political parties, parliamentary political parties, it was within, say, organizations like the Christian Democrats, which are the PP here, who lost all their seats, which weren't very many at that point anymore, in 2022, and last night regained a few as part of this coalition with the Social Democrats, with the PSD. I don't know exactly how many. This is the one thing I need to figure out, because there's definitely one seat that they got for sure, but I think they got some more. It's just that obviously because they're running as a coalition, it's hard without looking at every single candidate, every single MP that they put through, to see which ones are from which party. But I need to do that in due course. Probably later today I'll start. I'll use my evening for that level of nerdiness. But this is the sort of big difference, I guess, between Spain and Portugal, is that the more truly reactionary fascistic forces were outside of the political center right, and when they existed, they were often within a Christian Catholic space or ideology within the Christian Democrats. On occasion, a few within the PSD, but again, never of significant, expression, to the point they would form a ring or something like that. That said, it is absolutely true that Xiga is a split, if you like, although it really, it's a split as much as a vanity project as a split in this case, from someone who was a PSD, a Conservative Party member, and rumored protege of the former Prime Minister Pedro Pascoal, the Prime Minister that Conservative Prime Minister who put Portugal through one of the harshest periods of austerity the country has ever seen, I believe profound reactionary, not only from a fiscal perspective but also from a social perspective, so much so that during these election campaign, he was making speeches on the danger of open borders and the migration policies of this country. So very much adopting openly the rhetoric of Xiga whilst still being a very open PSD figure. So much so that the leader of PSD, Luís Montenegro, was heckled on the streets for basically bringing Pascoal onto the campaign trail with him. Not only because of that, also because of, Pedro Pascoal being associated with the Troika, with austerity, with, truly horrendously quickly diminishing living standards in this country at the quickest rate one we've ever seen. There's more to that than just his slippery slope into far right politics. But there is that. So I don't think that's a coincidence. But really, Xiga comes out of, to the degree, André Ventura says it himself, the two party system in which PS and PSD are often hard to distinguish from a policy perspective, that is perhaps a little bit of an outdated point at this stage, within the last 10 years or so, but nonetheless still rings true to many, if not in terms of the actual politics of these two parties, then certainly the lived experiences of people, under these two administrations, the 2011 to 2015 PSD leadership that brought in the Troika, and ever since the Socialist Party under Costa. The truth is, on the ground, at the end of the day, people have lived badly. They've you know, suffered fools. They've been having to cope with very low wages and ever increasing cost of living in, you know, in 10 years apart, but nonetheless true. So yeah, Shige basically comes out of a diminishing purpose for PSD, for a traditional conservative neoliberal party. The diminishing quality of life in this country, and therefore the resentment that has created amongst the most vulnerable populations, or even just amongst, you know, in general, the population. And then obviously a kind of new generation that no longer lives with the personal experience of either dictatorship or recent revolution. And so I wouldn't say there is a generational amnesia, but there's definitely something of a withering of the symbolic power that event has had, those events have had on the way that people vote.
And what were the main sort of drivers of mobilization for Che Guevara? Was it their slogan this time around was Limpiar Portugal, no, like clean up Portugal? Like, so it was sort of an anti-corruption slogan, reminiscent in that sense maybe of Bolsonaro against Lula. Or it wasn't against Lula, but against the Workers' Party. And, you know, in the sense, obviously, you get a lot of the same types of policies. I mean, Chega is in favor of specific confinement for gypsies during the pandemic, chemical castration for sexual aggressors, attacks on the welfare state, anti-immigrant policies, anti-feminist, anti-LGBTQ policies. But in different countries, there are different focuses, different things, different sort of lines of mobilizations work better. Obviously, anti-immigration is a key driver in France and Italy, for example, the Netherlands. In Spain, it tends to be anti-feminism and anti-Catalan, anti-independentist feeling, along with anti-sort of leftism. You know, you can look at Trump, the differences between his campaigns, Bolsonaro, yeah, the sort of very much anti-leftism. How do you explain Chega's ability to grow so, you know, to increase its vote three times when you have on a very high level of participation? Yeah, was it sort of like an anti-elite, like very much a populist line of like, you know, to clean the Lisbon swamp type thing?
First, let me just say that the parallels between Bolsonaro and Ventura are not coincidental at all. There's been money. And I'm not just being a conspiracy theorist here. There's been reported lines of financing from Brazil into Portugal, especially from, once again, evangelical networks.
I've read that seems to have been a big thing, both from North America, from Trump and from Bolsonaro.
Yeah.
If I'm not wrong, yeah.
Yeah, which is, you know, again, interesting to observe in a nation that is still predominantly Catholic, but also on top of that, to a party and a particular leader who makes Catholicism so much part of his brand, right? Like yesterday, when the exit polls came out and the journalists surrounded him to ask him what he was going to do next, his answer was, it was before the exit polls came around, it was when he voted. When he voted, the journalists came surrounded him and asked, what are you going to do with the rest of your day? And he said, you know, I'm going to spend it with family, rest a little bit, and I'm going to go to mass. And then we'll see. And then, you know, the exit polls will come out and we'll see. So, you know, he makes this whole point of saying several times that he goes to mass, he's going to go to mass, etc. And this is Catholic mass, of course, not an evangelical service. So it is an interesting dynamic that here happening demographically. I think it's something that will be better observed in a few years' time in hindsight. Because on the ground, I guess unless you're within those networks, they're so subtle within Portuguese society at this point that you can't really see them. But anyway, returning to your point of why, or your question over why Shiga has done so well, I feel, and perhaps I'm wrong in this, but I don't think I am, because there's no other, there's no evidence to the contrary. I think Shiga does well because it picks up on exactly a little bit of, you know, it's almost like a smorgasbord of the far right of the world, certainly of the, you know, so-called developed world or northern, global north. It brings up the populist, social-oriented rhetoric of Trump when it comes to industry, you know, revitalizing Portuguese sovereignty through its industry, through its workers. Not that he uses the word workers in the same way that the Communist Party would, but it certainly uses the word workers. Although I should add that Ventura's favorite and very first slogan, I think, was the good people, people of good, in an almost like literal translation, pessoas de bem, which sounds incredibly naff, but is actually incredibly dangerous and pernicious, really, as political rhetoric is concerned. But then it also brings, of course, the question of immigration, completely, you know, inflated, because there isn't really an issue. I mean, there is an issue with immigration with most countries, but there certainly is an issue of immigration with this with Portugal, because A, it doesn't take in that many migrants, that it would truly have an impact on demographically. It is true that a lot of the lowest and most dangerous and volatile jobs in this country are currently, certainly the more visible ones, are being done by migrant laborers, namely within agriculture, but not only. But that is, again, such a minor sliver of society that perhaps is more, you know, visually easy to identify, because there's been a series of, you know, scandals of workers' abuses in Portuguese agricultural landscape, people that end up living, you know, like 10 men in one tiny moldy room and so on. So these cases have been covered by the media because of the human rights abuses, but they happen to have coincidentally also been migrant workers. At the end of the day, the percentage of migrant workers in this country is insignificant, almost inexpressive. So there isn't really an issue with migration in this country, but Ventura uses it anyway. The same can be said, of course, about Portuguese ethnic minorities, be it the Gypsy Traveler community or the Black Portuguese Black community. Although Shiga has been, at this stage, relatively cautious with the way in which it talks about race, other than when it comes to the Gypsy Traveler Portuguese community. Again, I think because André Ventura and Shiga's project tries to emulate a lot of other far-right parties that like to brand the fact that, you know, like brandish the fact that we're not racist. Look, we have Black people in our midst, a bit like UKIP did at one point, in fact. But then ultimately its policies are profoundly prejudice towards racialized communities, including Black Portuguese people. Then it takes on, trying to think of other, well, I mean, obviously it takes on one of the Spanish, also Spanish brands of far right policy, which is again sexism and reversing women's rights. Or LGBT rights, for that matter. So it expresses incredibly prejudiced, to say the least, views on gay marriage, on trans rights, on gay rights at large, but also, although more quietly, made several points on things like abortion, you know, Planned Parenthood, and so on and so forth. Or family planning and so on and so forth. So, you know, it kind of goes and picks up And by the way, when I say Spain, in this case, also very similar in Brazil, which perhaps culturally at times resonates a bit more with the Portuguese cultural, you know, sort of psychological space. So, you know, like Ventura as a true smooth operator within politics goes and, you know, picks and chooses whatever he feels is going to resonate within the Portuguese, the various Portuguese discontentments of various different Portuguese constituencies. And that's why he had such a good result last night, you know. And I do often say André Ventura, because Chega, at least until now, would not exist if he were to step down, go somewhere else, go to another party, whatever. It's very much like UKIP and Nigel Farage. Chega without André Ventura is a shell. It doesn't really exist. That said, and I've been wanting to say this in other outlets, and I haven't been able to yet because it's been difficult to get to this point. That said, we now have nearly 50 parliamentarians who belong to Chega. It could well be that other charismatic, strategically minded people are amongst them, or now have the space to grow politically or to be educated politically. And yeah, so it wouldn't be unimaginable that Chega could now truly survive and thrive even without André Ventura. But until now, André Ventura is the main character. The second main character, and that's a recent development as well from these elections, or the last year and a half, 2 years, is this young woman who's also been becoming a bit more famous. But politically, she is, how to call this? Like, she's very innate and unprepared, let's say. You know, there's been many a debate and many an interview where she quotes stats that are, you know, very obviously totally wrong, where she misunderstands people's jobs and the roles of certain institutions and so on. So while she has certainly become the young face of the party, it's unlikely that she'll become a successor to Ventura anytime soon. Which is just as what Ventura likes it, right? Of course, because he needs to be the big honcho and in control of everything. Otherwise, this party that is truly a vanity project of this megalomaniac, you know, truly deranged man, wouldn't exist.
I mean, I do want to get on to talk about the socialists in a minute, but one last question about Chega was, I mean, do we know much about their exact electorate? I mean, is this, you know, is this sort of a bit like Maloney or Vox, you know, more the radicalization of existing right-wing constituencies rather than, for example, with Le Pen, was always able to at least, you know, was able to sort of make inroads into sort of ex-communist strongholds, etc. Whereas, you know, in other places, it's very much the radicalization of existing right-wing constituencies. Is that the case with Chega? I also see that it's particularly popular among younger voters. Again, that's something similar in Spain. Though normally, again, we're talking people who come from right-wing or conservative backgrounds, were brought up in religious households, etc. Is that the case in Portugal? And yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying there is very interesting in terms of, yeah, I think within certain constituencies, the attraction of someone who's, you know, willing to say it as it is and be politically incorrect, as with Trump, etc. But sorry, yeah, what can you say about the electorate of Chega? What is its electoral coalition?
I mean, it is basically what you've just mentioned. There seems to be a particularly accentuated growth amongst younger voters, which is disconcerting, and I am hoping almost that it has more to do with what I was mentioning before, with a certain like political dysphagia of what democracy really means and how hard previous generations fought for it to be gained in Portugal, you know, for basic freedoms to be gained in Portugal. And there seems to be a younger generation that has that no longer has a relationship with that struggle. I hope that's the reason why they're attracted to Shiga rather than a genuine belief in the policies. But you know, who knows? I'm not on TikTok, so maybe I'm out of touch.
I guess that is one of the interesting questions. No, I mean, I guess the idea of millennial socialism was that younger people were moving more towards the left. We're nearly getting a Zoomer move in the other direction. You know, you can see it.
Here.
But again, it's always hard to know. You know, when you, these are such broad terms, and particularly, you know, if we're really just talking about a sort of radicalization of existing right-wing constituencies, where okay, they're no longer, you know, these younger people 20 years ago would have voted for the mainstream right, and now they're being seduced by this sort of extreme right populism, as opposed to younger people who might, you know, who would have voted for the socialists 2 years ago, moving over. I mean, I imagine there's very little transfer of votes between, you know, in that direction.
I mean, it's hard because I would have to like would have to cross a series of different points of data, including the fact that despite the or because perhaps in the sense of the proportional representational system in this country, it means that you nonetheless get some areas where you have more votes for the Communist Party, but then in total you get more seats for Shiga, kind of thing. So there is that, which subsequently, what I'm trying to say, or conversely, what I'm trying to say is that there might be a lot of young people who are also voting for the far left, for Bloc, for CDU, which is the coalition, the electoral coalition between the Communists and the Greens, or in fact for this this pro-European Green, Socialist Green Party Livre, which has also quadrupled its seats, but from 1 to 4 rather than from 14 to 48. Whether this sort of the youth is all for the far right, the Gen Zers are all part of the red pill brigade, I'm not entirely sure. Although there's something to be said about the way in which far right rhetoric and fascistic rhetoric in Portugal, like everywhere else, has been very apt at adopting means of communication and dissemination that are mostly second nature to younger generations. You know, things like podcasts and streaming and TikTok. All these means of you know, infotainment, let's say, that are of which the audiences are not only, but in great part, younger people. But yeah, going back to I was just going to go back to Shiga's constituency. I mean, it isn't an odd coalition, and you know, a lot of the people that vote Shiga will probably not be the likeliest of friends. I would have said, because they will have different priorities. Some of these will be, you know, let's say lower middle class millennials in the outskirts of Lisbon who feel like their social mobility prospects have been curtailed by the socialists or by divestment from funds that could go into privatizing things into the welfare state. Who knows what kind of cockamamie arguments they will bring, but basically people that feel they were shortchanged on social mobility. And this, by the way, is social mobility from upper working class to lower middle class onto the higher echelons of yuppiness, let's say. So not necessarily from poverty onto a sort of well-established middle class. So it goes from that to, you know, yes, impoverished working class, truly working, you know, almost like the most stereotypical working class communities in deep Alentejo, which is the agricultural heartland. It's a bit like Andalusia in Spain. In fact, it's adjacent to Andalusia. and culturally and physically and everything very similar to Andalusia. So they're working class communities that have voted, they're stalwarts of the Communist Party since 74, and who now are predominantly voting Sheikh. And that, in fact, is a trope of Sheikh for not of this particular election. It has happened over and over again, that they boast of the fact that they have taken voters from the Communist Party, because really, that's their argument. These people were never to the left. They were just, misunderstood or whatever. And the same can be said about Fad, which is the capital of the Algarve, an area where there is an incredible juxtaposition between, British pensioners and some of the most impoverished Portuguese communities, people that truly live hand to mouth, previous fishing communities, then turned into the industrial sectors, then sent onto the streets when those industrial sectors were outsourced to who knows where, Morocco, Eastern Asia, you name it. This is another completely different demographic for Shiga. And then there are the evangelicals who are growing in Portugal for sure, and not just within foreign or migrant communities like Brazilian communities, although that's where it first started, that's their inception. But there's definitely now a lot of Portuguese people, quote unquote indigenous, who are now also evangelical. And I'm trying to think of other very obvious constituencies for Sheikh, but there must be others because of their growth, Yeah. It is really something to now, in the aftermath of this election, to go and look at more carefully. And also what they demand, right? Like, what are these people saying? What are they trying to say? I think it would be an error of judgment of the left or of the political spectrum at large to just ignore these as, people who are very upset and uneducated about what Sheikh is really about. There is something being said here that needs to be listened to and needs to be addressed, certainly with policies, but possibly also with political rhetoric.
I mean, obviously, what's quite interesting is the fact that the mainstream right coalition led by the PSD didn't increase its vote share. Actually, I think it's ever so slightly decreased. But
indeed.
But why it has come out on top is a pretty heavy collapse in the socialist vote from 2 years ago. There's been a lot of questions about why these elections were called. Were they necessary? On the one hand, why did Costa resign? I mean, was there an element of lawfare involved here, in the sense you have this corruption investigation launched around, I think, renewable energy schemes and projects. His name seemed to appear in one of the affidavits, and then that seemed to be an error. There were a lot of charges being thrown around at the beginning. A lot of them seems to have disappeared. Was there an element of lawfare, and did he jump too fast? I mean, the socialists could have had another 2 years in office.
They're almost like two different questions. I mean, question on whether it's lawfare, I think there is an element of that. There certainly has been a need, desperate need, for justice reform of the judicial in Portugal for a long time. That has been very often intertwined with this, with cases of corruption. And I say this because there's been various cases of corruption, bankruptcy, and it's not even misappropriation of funds, although that has also happened, but just sort of like jobs for the boys. The elite ends up being all in it together somehow, because the person who knew, the person who appointed, the person who's now the CEO or the former CEO and is now a minister or an advisor to, and this happens to both parties, by the way, to both the conservatives and to the socialists. All of that has happened time and time again in the last 20 years, if not longer, in Portugal.
It seemed quite a coincidence that that António Costa's name appeared in these investigations, and then in the paperwork, in the affidavits, and then suddenly, I think after he'd resigned, it was revealed that it was a mistake. His name wasn't they were referring to a different Costa. Is that correct to say?
Yes, a different Antonio Costa.
Okay, a different Antonio Costa. Oh my God.
Yeah. So in Portugal, you know, we have various surnames that are very popular, very common. And what happens is, what most people do is they use two surnames. Often they're even almost like, you know, they're not double barrel because they're not hyphenated, but they're used together. They're the family names, two surnames, in order for it to be a bit different. So I don't remember what the second surname of the other minister was, but yes. So Sampaio Costa. Oh, okay. This is what happens when you have 4 hours sleep after an electoral night. But yes. Yeah, so basically, the even that was the report was that. So it wasn't even a guaranteed fact. They definitely made a mistake. Reported after Antonio Costa, the prime minister, resigned, it was reported that in the transcripts from the tapped phones, the wiretapped phones that had picked up and triggered the investigation, had been mistranscribed. And therefore, the Antonio Costa that people were referring to, or the Costa rather, because they were just using one surname, wasn't Antonio Costa, who only uses Costa as a surname. So he's only known as Antonio Costa, the prime minister, the outgoing prime minister. But really, they were talking about something, Sampaio Costa, let's say. I really can't remember his full surname, and we need to Google it now. And therefore, they're referring to a minister rather than the prime minister. Now, this obviously gave rise to a series of theories, some of which more conspiratorial than others. But I genuinely do think that in this country, I mean, it could be anything. It could be purposeful. It could be, you know, willingful negligence. Who knows? But in this country, unfortunately, I would also not put aside the possibility of it simply being people being bad at their job, not being well informed, not being well briefed, rushing through things, being overworked, badly paid, and hating their job, really. And therefore, sure, as they're typing, I mean, I'm not sure if these things are done by AI yet, but whoever is either transcribing or making sense of the transcripts, clearly, you know, it could well be that they simply did not have just the knowledge that there is a minister with this very similar name to the prime minister, and therefore they immediately assumed it was a prime minister, and that's it. And then that goes straight on to the course of justice. So, you know, like, Portugal, in many respects, is a bit of a Chekhovian play, you know. So I wouldn't put it to the, you know, I wouldn't put aside the possibility of just someone being bad at their jobs.
I think because I've lived in Spain too long now, I see politics behind everything. You know, I mean, there's a huge sort of campaign of lawfare against the progressive coalition government here in very, you know, we've seen it with the Catalan amnesty most recently. You know, bringing ludicrous charges against Catalan leaders like Puigdemont. You know, supposedly now he's under investigation for terrorism. I mean, it's incredible. And obviously, the paradigm case is Brazil, is the work, the rise of Bolsonaro. Yeah, Dilma, like, you know, Dilma Rousseff had won, you know, a massive majority, very, very, you know, again, you know, very, you know, won the presidential election by a landslide, and then was brought down in this sort of. Obviously, there is a lot of corruption in Brazil as well, but she and Lula largely seemed, you know, clean compared to everybody else involved. I mean,
well, this is the travesty. Yeah. This is travesty in this country. There is definitely a lot of corruption, petty corruption from, you know, influence peddling, jobs for the boys type of approach to genuine corruption and misappropriation of funds and money laundering and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, it continuously gets muddled up in a judicial system that is just not necessarily corrupt or, you know, controlled by force A or force B, but just lacking the resources very often to do not even a good job, just a decent job. So you know, it is a little bit of Republic of Bananas kind of vibes here at times. And in fact, I would say that played in favor of Chega very often, and is perhaps even more worrying in terms of a trend, is this growing distrust of institutions, state institutions, the pillars of a democracy, not only because there are populist forces sort of fanning those flames, but also because there's a series of events that lead people to feel, well, how am I supposed to trust the judicial system when my case, which was something simple like, you know, small debt or whatever it might be, for even a personal individual foreclosure, you name it, is dealt with badly, inappropriately, but somewhat rapidly. And then these enormous cases, which often snowball into cases within cases and investigations within investigations, take so long to disentangle, so long to investigate and figure out, so long to hit the courts, that by the time they do, they've lapsed. And there is this disenchantment and disillusionment with the pillars of democracy that I find really the most dangerous thing of all. Because of course, then most people who find themselves being disenchanted are also easy prey for opportunists like Andre Ventura and Shirka.
I mean, in that sense, I'm going to reframe my previous question about whether Costa should have resigned or not. Because I mean, in one sense, his resignation has, you know, created this opening for Czech and, you know, to mount a campaign centered on corruption, etc. I mean, that's one element on a sort of tactical short-term basis. The other element is the fact that after 8 years, you know, over 8 years in office, you have this housing crisis, this cost of living crisis. I mean, when you look at Portugal, even more so than Spain, I mean, the minimum wage, I think, is only 800 euro, a little over 800 euro, like 25 or something like that, I think. But the cost of rent, you know, renting in Portugal is in the major cities of Portugal is extremely high.
Getting to London sort of standard.
Exactly. I mean, you have, you know, in a country with 800 euro minimum wage, and yeah, you're one of the, it's now one of the most expensive countries in Europe to rent. After eight, going on towards 9 years in office, the Portuguese Socialist Party wasn't able to advance an ambitious housing policy to tackle this crisis or get on top of the wider cost of living crisis. That sort of contrast with the previous austerity regime obviously looks very positive, but their sort of reformist drive, their reformist agenda sort of, to a certain extent, only went so far and wasn't able to tackle basic material issues affecting their, you know, their citizens.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the main takeaway, I think, from 8 years of socialist government has been the fact that they fell short on their promise, certainly for the actual left forces that either voted for them or hoped that they would deliver a big difference from or a genuinely different governance from what the conservatives have done. I don't know if these squeaks are a bit too loud for you.
No, you're no worries at all. No,
it's just my child suckling on a dummy. I mean, as you say, with housing, let's put it, take this in parts. When it comes to Costa, could it be seen as his own attempt to perhaps readdress this lack of trust in political institutions? So I do wonder whether that was why he did it. I wonder whether it was a more personal decision and he just decided, I've had enough and I would like a break now. He did lead Portugal through post-austerity years, pandemic, and, you know, post-pandemic, aftermath of pandemic, cost of living crisis, you name it. It's hard to see why. I don't think he necessarily left with the total confidence that the socialists would win again, and therefore that's why he could leave. He has, however, seemed incredibly relaxed throughout his media presence, both when he was indicted or named in the affidavit, but also since, you know, now perhaps since a bit more understandably, but he's always said, you know, if there's anyone to be blamed for PS's bad results or bad legacy, he was the one who was happy to take on the blame, etc. So he's always taken this sort of very senior statesman-like approach to the whole thing. if one were to be not necessarily conspiracy theorist, but, you know, strategist, and Costa is probably one of the most cunning political operators in Portuguese history, certainly in Portuguese recent history, one could wonder whether did he use the fact that he was named in the affidavit as an opportunity to reset the political scene by playing the long term, thinking, okay, PS will probably lose the next elections, but the next elections won't be won outright either. So we'll go back to the polls and then PS can come back stronger, something along those, you know, that kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
Square of a circle.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I imagine a strong Chega, for example, in the next elections, you could sort of polarizing between left and right. He would be very much the anti-fascist bulwark for everybody who wants to avoid a far-right presence in government.
And one could even argue to a degree that the destruction of Chega will come the closer they get to power, because obviously their promises cannot be, reformed. They cannot have lower taxes and higher investment in social infrastructure. That's just not, unfortunately, how it works. Where's the money going to come from? So the closer, very in the, historical materialist dialectic way, the closer Chega gets to power, the more likely it is to fall, unless there is then constitutional changes and then, truly dictatorial kind of worrying the changes and then developments in the meantime. But as things are, the closer Chega gets to power, the likeness it will be that a lot of people would be disenchanted with them as well. Could Costa be playing that game? I mean, it's a dangerous, very long-term game in a sense, especially for a man in his 60s. But, I'm no Socialist Party member or voter, but he is such a cunning character that from a more analytical perspective, he's almost like a Game of Thrones type of character, and in the background,
3D chess.
What's the next? Yeah, the next step you'll take. So it could well be that's the case. Who knows? He's certainly a very fascinating, political force.
Oh, sorry. And a last question. Why hasn't the radical left or the communist left, the Bloc or the Communist Party, managed to take advantage of the fall in the socialist vote share? I mean, if you look back in 2015, Bloco were on just over 10%, the communists on 8.25%. This time around, Bloco got less than 5%, 4.46. The communists got 3.3. I mean, they haven't been able to take advantage of the socialist losses. What is the left of the socialists? What's gone wrong for them?
Well, for the communists, it's a little bit more obvious, I would say. In great part, the new leader, as nice as he is, isn't very charismatic, I guess. So that played a role, as well as obviously, to a certain degree, a sense of general attrition from the fact that the left at large has been not at large, it's been a socialist, but that sense that the left has been in power for a while. And the fact that both Bloco and the communists were in the Geringonça and the contraption sort of confidence and supply agreement with the PS in between 2015 and 2019. And that is why between 2015 and 2019, both Bloc and the Communist Party dropped in numbers quite significantly. Their association with the Socialist Party either rendered them redundant for certain voters, because, if they're going to, I might as well vote Socialist Party if that's the case, or, made some people very upset about the fact that they were collaborating so closely allowing for certain policies or certain laws to be put through by the Socialist Party, in spite of the fact that the Left Bloc and the Communist Party were involved in governance to some degree as well. So that close association did some damage. And I think there's still a little bit of that, a bit of residue there. Why did the left bloc not do better, despite the fact that it has a different leader and, in my opinion, a far more, I don't know how to describe it, because it's not like a former leader was a bad one. It's just that Marina Mortágua, who is the current leader of the left bloc, is a younger, she's very agile in debates. She took a very important role during an inquest into the bankruptcy, I guess, of the sort of biggest or second biggest private bank in Portugal, and she led the inquiry rather that followed from that very astutely, and was able to put a lot of, you know, big fat cats of Portugal in check through her questions, and, you know, she rose to prominence through that. So it's not someone who the Portuguese public wouldn't know. They all knew her even before she was leader. Then they knew her as leader, and she was really very good in debates, very assertive, and politically very, very interesting as well. So why they haven't done better? It does boggle the mind. I mean, their vote share increased a little bit, but not as much as I would have thought, even if I wasn't expecting a huge increase, but I was expecting a little bit better than they did. So I'm not sure whether, I mean, I think ultimately, and unfortunately, one must come to the conclusion that some of the votes that used to go to the bloc who went to the Communist Party have ended up trickling into Chega. Whether those are temporary votes of people who take little interest in the intricacies of politics and just think, well, I don't like things as they are, I voted bloc before, and now I'll just try and vote Chega instead. Or whether these are people who know exactly who they're voting for and feel like these two powers are interchangeable, or these three powers, what are these two forces, the left, the far left and the far right, are interchangeable. I'm not entirely sure if there's some sort of like entropy going on here. It's very clear that there isn't the same momentum behind the Communist Party and the left bloc as there was certainly in 2019. That's not to say that they couldn't come back. You know, some people define these things as, oh, this is the death knell of that party or the other party. I don't think that's necessarily the case. But I think that currently, I think the bloc was in the right direction. It definitely has been offering and been, you know, campaigning on the things that a lot of people really are interested in. Rent controls, for instance, and just more housing, affordable housing, as well as, you know, better contracts that aren't precarious, you know, against precarity, you name it. Sort of the chagrins of both millennial and Gen Z generations. The Communist Party is a bit harder one to crack, because the Communist Party has lived on almost like a legacy of members, both the ones that obviously were members of the Communist Party throughout the dictatorship and after the revolution, but also to some degree their children and grandchildren, interestingly enough, because it's a very, you know, sort of community, as in local communities, organized party, and then it has its very, you know, sort of stone crystallized structures that repeated themselves despite their limitations, but keep repeating themselves, but also within those very limitations. And so perhaps now the decrease in votes also indicates that these, you know, almost ancient structures need a little bit of reform, a little bit of plasticity coming through them. And they certainly, absolutely certainly need either a leader who is better at playing the political game, unfortunately. And I say this unfortunately because the political game is BS, but also otherwise to train Paulo Raimundo, who is their leader. He was good politically. He's very good. It's just that it had such a little impact. He looked so beige in a world that needed, in a campaign that needed a lot more. So yeah, there's something there. There's some, an injection of newness is needed somewhere in the Communist Party. I think it's up to their leadership and their members to decide where, but something needs to change a little bit. It doesn't, they don't have to reinvent the wheel quite the opposite. I think they just need to go towards where their usual, you know, supporters are and find what their new demands, new wishes, new aspirations are, and try to find it there. But it's not going to be an easy road for those two, I'm afraid. It's again, a little bit worrying. I take heart from the fact that Livre was able to grow. It's an interesting party. It's at times in practice a bit more liberal left than just left. But it nonetheless has attracted a lot of really interesting campaigners, members, supporters, possibly voters as well. I fear that some of those came from the left bloc anyway. There are people, as in, I mean, the Livre is a split from the left bloc anyway, but the voters come from previous left bloc voters. But nonetheless, I'm hoping that there's also something new there that could show the way. So I think it'd be, for the left, it's interesting, and it should be a case to look at, as well as, again, look at what happened to Shiga, why Shiga got where they got, and what can the left do to truly listen to what the voters of Shiga are saying, and whether it can address those concerns, not just through pointing the finger, although I'm sure there's plenty of that there to point the finger at, but also through some sort of, like, you know, truly passionate mobilizing within those forces, and showing that, yes, we need to be shown new alternatives, we need to be shown new futures, but Shig is not going to be the power that does that. It may sound as much because they are the newest kid on the block, but it truly isn't. In practice, what they offer is further division and further impoverishment and further opportunities for big enterprises to make a buck out of the average Portuguese worker. And it is the left that has an offer that is, you know, consciously minded, based on solidarity and building something together. It's easier said than done, of course, but it will have to be done.
Okay, well, great. I mean, I think that's a good place to leave it. Thanks a lot, Joanna, for your very insightful and thorough analysis.
My pleasure, Owen.
And we have to give a shout out to your son, who's been amazing, as you know. he really hasn't made much noise in the last hour and a half, so
The newest Portuguese citizen. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Speak soon.